From Public Radio International, this is The World. A co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. It's Thursday, February 3rd. I'm Marco Werman. More violence in Egypt, some of it involving pro-government groups attacking foreign journalists.
They were telling us that we were anti-Mubarak, that we were anti-Egyptians. We were telling lies and we were not telling the world that Mubarak was a good president.
Also, another crisis looms for Egypt. This one involves other countries controlling the waters of the Nile.
Egyptians have depended on the Nile for 5,000 years. It's ingrained into their national psyche.
PRI's The World is brought to you by the Medtronic Foundation, partnering with Mended Hearts to provide online and hospital support to newly diagnosed heart disease patients. Learn more at mendedhearts.org.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Egypt's President Hosni Mubarak told ABC News today that he would like to step down, but in an interview with ABC correspondent Christian Amanpour, Mubarak said he feared chaos if he resigned now. His comments came after another day of violence in Cairo. Sporadic gunfire in Tahrir Square earlier today as Mubarak supporters continued to clash with opponents of the regime. There are reports that at least 10 people have died in the violence, with hundreds more injured. Also today, Mubarak's new vice president appeared on state television to announce that neither the president nor his son would stand for election in September. It was the first official indication that Gamal Mubarak would not succeed his father. That would have been huge news a week ago, but Egypt is not the same country it was even a few days ago. The World's Matthew Bell is in Cairo monitoring events for us. Besides that announcement, Matthew, from the vice president, Egypt's prime minister also spoke on state TV and had some noteworthy comments today.
That's right. The brand new prime minister, Ahmed Shafik, held a news conference, and he apologized for the violence yesterday. He said it wouldn't happen again, and then he repeatedly said that the government would find those responsible and punish them.
There was also word today that the country's most organized opposition group, the Muslim Brotherhood, has been invited to meet with the government as part of a national dialogue. Is that announcement going to appease anti-government protesters?
I think this move is really about tomorrow, Marco. There are huge demonstrations planned again for Friday, which is the Muslim day of prayer. The Brotherhood has taken more and more of a role in these demonstrations. I think this offer by the government could be an attempt to pull the Brotherhood, which is very organized, away from the other demonstrators, if you will, sort of a divide and conquer kind of a strategy.
Well, things are tenuous today for journalists in the streets of Cairo. We'll hear more about that in a bit. But you were out today, Matthew, and talking to demonstrators. Let's hear your report.
After a long night of violent clashes in Tahrir Square, the place looked and felt like a war zone. At a makeshift medical center in the square, a demonstrator who was in the middle of clashes last night described what she saw.
We were surrounded from the four sides of the square. They came bringing already stones, swords, knives, any kind of weapon you can imagine, and even guns, gun machine. So we didn't expect to see that.
She said after about 3 a.m., things got really violent, so she left the battle zone to help with the wounded. Another medical volunteer said it was a bloody night.
We see a lot of injuries, cut wounds, we see contusions, we see broken bones. And after gunshots, we got internal hemorrhage. People from Qasr Aini Hospital, a friend of mine told me that they have people with internal hemorrhage with all kinds of injuries.
Out in the square, the atmosphere was tense. The Egyptian military had formed a cordon around the square. Demonstrators prepared for more street fighting. They set up barricades and piled up stones in key places in case they had to retreat. I talked with a group of men outside a mosque, some of them bandaged up from last night's melee, and they told me they would stay and fight until President Mubarak leaves.
Justice has to take place.
Someone told me just now that getting freedom will be painful.
Yeah. And when we have dictator, this takes place.
So 30 days is not that much.
30 days is not that much.
Yeah. For sure.
You want something, do something.
If you want something, do something.
We believe so.
By profession, Amjad Haykal is a judge, but early this morning he walked into Tahrir Square and joined anti-government demonstrators.
I came, there was stone throwing from that bridge for an hour. And they captured one from us and we captured one from them. He was a police officer from the secret police officers.
That's something the demonstrators were keen to talk about today. They've been saying that yesterday's attack on the square was orchestrated by the Egyptian government and that former police and security agents took part. But not everyone I talked with today supported the demonstrations. Some of last night's fighting took place right outside this woman's building. Now, she said, she wants the demonstrators to go home.
These kids don't know what famine is. They don't know what's to be hungry. They don't know anything for the last 30 years. One young girl once said, "Oh, we are starving." I said, "You have your cell phone. How many pair of shoes do you have? Do you eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner?" She said, "Of course." I said, "You cannot be hungry." They don't know nothing. They are just I call them the PlayStation generation. They are not aware of lots of things.
A sample there of those who don't support the anti-Mubarak protests. Matthew Bell in Cairo is back on the line with us. Matthew, we're also hearing that supporters of President Mubarak are targeting foreign journalists. Some reporters apparently have been beaten, others detained. How free are you to walk around Cairo and interview people?
I got out and about a bit today and spent some time walking around the square. And I didn't have any serious trouble, Marco, but I could feel, you know, I was getting some dirty looks. At one point, I was interviewing someone, and a guy came up and started accusing me of being an Israeli and told people not to talk to me. Another time, this guy came up to me and took my picture with his cell phone and asked me what my name was, which was a bit unsettling. I also just talked to another journalist who's staying at another hotel and said that they've actually been barricaded in. They're not letting any journalists in or out of the building.
A tense situation for sure. The World's Matthew Bell with the latest from Cairo. Matthew, stay safe. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks, Marco.
Dozens of foreign journalists in Egypt have been attacked, harassed, and even detained during the past 24 hours. That includes reporters and cameramen working for major outlets like CNN, the BBC, and the New York Times. The U.S. State Department has condemned the crackdown on the press as part of a concerted campaign to intimidate. That campaign also appears to include pro-Mubarak groups airing conspiracy theories about the role of the foreign press in this crisis. Here's more from reporter Ursula Lindsay in Cairo.
Alvaro Zamarino Ortega is among the many foreign journalists in Cairo who've been attacked. He works for a radio station in Spain. He says his team was assaulted by pro-government groups yesterday.
Part of our team was physically attacked in one of the entrances to Tahrir Square. We were broadcasting from a car, which was clearly indicated as press. Then a group of people started to gather around the car. Firstly, they just insulted our team, but then they started to hit the car. They broke several glasses, and they attacked to our technician.
Ortega says he and his team took refuge with the army and were told to leave the area. But before doing so, they did manage to interview some of the pro-Mubarak groups.
And they were telling us that we were anti-Mubarak, that we were anti-Egyptians. We were telling lies and we were not telling the world that Mubarak was a good president and that he was a legitimate president of the country. They were telling us that this was all, you know, something orchestrated from the States and Israel, even when we told them, but Israel is one of the few countries that is more or less supporting Mubarak. No, this is Obama's and Netanyahu's conspiracy against Mubarak and the Egyptian people.
It has long been a tactic of government officials here to cast domestic tensions and demands for reform as part of alleged foreign plots against the country. And that's a claim being heard now on Egypt state-run TV. Today, a presenter on state TV interviewed young Egyptian men who claimed they had been inside Tahrir Square among the protesters. "I saw people who are not Egyptians," one of the men says. "It's a conspiracy. It's not the same people that came out on January 25th, another says, referring to the peaceful protest last Tuesday that started it all. "These are strange people." "I saw one man who just wasn't Egyptian," the man adds. Others in the background yell, "It was a Jew, an Israeli." Another man breaks in to say that he and his friends caught someone who turned out to be Iranian. He says it as if that is proof of foul play. Overall, the mood in the Egyptian capital has changed for the hundreds of foreign journalists here to cover what had been a mostly peaceful anti-government uprising. Now downtown Cairo is a no-man's land where it's hard to gauge what people's reaction will be. Again, the Spanish journalist Alvaro Zamarino Ortega.
Usually we cover things in which we have both sides clearly divided, or you have the police or the soldiers and then you have the people, and you more or less know how to manage with them. The problem yesterday is that you don't know who is who, in which side is who, and why are they so aggressive to you when they even don't know, even if you are a journalist, which kind of things are you reporting, or that you are just doing your job.
Pro-Mubarak groups have reportedly been particularly aggressive to reporters they think might be working for Al Jazeera. The Qatar-based TV network has given the anti-government protests sympathetic wall-to-wall coverage. And many Egyptians have been able to see that coverage on their TV screens. But now, Al Jazeera has been removed from Egypt's state-run satellite channel lineup, and the government has ordered the network to shut its offices here. For The World, I'm Ursula Lindsay in Cairo.
It's not only foreign journalists who've been under pressure in Egypt. Local journalists are also caught up in the clash between pro- and anti-Mubarak forces. Yesterday, Egyptian journalist Shahira Amin resigned from her job at Nile TV, the Egyptian state television channel. Amin says she felt she could no longer work there because she'd been forced to keep some information from the public.
I just decided I couldn't be part of the propaganda machine. I can't feed the public lies. I haven't done that. I've been working for them since 1989 with state television, even before Nile TV came into being. And I've always given the facts as they are. And I decided that this once I couldn't, because I was handed press releases and I had to read them as they are. And I decided I can't do it.
Reading press releases wasn't the only problem for Shahira Amin. She says she and her colleagues were not being allowed to report on anti-government protesters.
Yesterday, I spent the whole day at Nile TV, and we were basically showing the pro-Mubarak rallies all day long, as if that was the only thing that was happening. I couldn't show what was happening here in Tahrir. I couldn't even report the figures as they are, so... No, thank you.
Amin says that while Nile TV has always presented the government's point of view, in the past she was able to get around the restrictions and could offer more objective news to viewers.
I managed before to get away with telling my stories, and I've tackled many taboo issues. I've received threats from security a number of times, but then nothing ever happened, and I kept on doing the stories. But... this time, we had strict instructions.
Shahira Amin says she doesn't know how any of her colleagues are feeling now about those strict instructions.
I didn't talk about it with anyone. I just walked out and I just vowed I would never go back.
That was Egyptian journalist Shahira Amin, who resigned from her job at the state-run television channel Nile TV yesterday. She was speaking from Tahrir Square in Cairo. The evolving situation in Egypt has all eyes focused on the region. For full coverage, head to theworld.org/Egypt. There you can find our on-the-ground reporting from The World's Matthew Bell, as well as slideshows of the protests in Cairo. We also have a new podcast from my colleague Lisa Mullins on the prospects for Islam and democracy coexisting in Egypt. That's all at theworld.org/Egypt. This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from the Medtronic Foundation, committed to changing the way the world treats chronic disease. Learn more at Medtronic.com. Medtronic, innovating for life.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. As the crisis in Egypt has escalated, a lot of people are desperate to try and catch a flight out of Egypt. Cairo International Airport is clogged with travelers. The United States and several other nations have organized charter flights to help their own citizens leave, and some of those chartered flights leaving Cairo are headed to, of all places, Baghdad. The Iraqi government is offering a free flight home to any of the 60,000 Iraqi nationals who live in Egypt. Correspondent Jane Aruff has been at the airport in Baghdad talking with Iraqis who are returning home from Egypt. It's ironic, Jane, that these Iraqis would see Baghdad as a safe haven compared to Cairo and Egypt. Is it a safe haven right now?
Well, it is one of those funny twists of fate that so often happens here, because it is, in comparison, absolutely a safe haven. Now, these are people who left like 4 or 5 years ago, some of them 3 years ago, in the height of the civil war. And they left because it was violent, because they couldn't stay anymore. Now, they're in Cairo and Alexandria. They're going on with their lives. And all of a sudden, this happens. They were all telling similar stories. They couldn't find bread. They couldn't find gasoline. They couldn't get cash out of the machine. And these are people who are used to staying safe. So what they did was they went to the airport. And the Iraqi government, in an uncharacteristically coordinated move, actually laid on planes to bring them back free of charge. Mm-hmm. 2,000 have come back so far, and more are expected.
Now, people who fled Iraq during the war were generally well-to-do professionals. Who are these Iraqis who have been returning from Egypt?
The ones who went to Egypt, who had the money to get there, tended to be middle class, relatively affluent and well-educated, the engineers, the doctors, the accountants, exactly the kind of people that Iraq needs here. And they were all saying that if things settle down in Egypt, they're on the next plane back as soon as things are safe again. Now, they didn't look like refugees. They arrived with kids on little scooters. There was one woman who had a poodle, a young puppy, and a little carrier case. They were all very fashionably dressed. It was sort of the elite of the refugee community, if you will. And again, the kind of people that Iraq hopes would come back, but they haven't fled Egypt to come back here to stay. They've just come to sit it out for a little bit.
And what have they had to say about what they saw in Cairo?
Really, they've seen this before. They were worried that it would deteriorate so quickly. Getting on that plane was their last chance to get out. But there was also a really interesting undercurrent of almost a kind of envy that this was a country where people actually took things into their own hands to topple a dictator. There was a satellite engineer I spoke to named Aday Dawood, who left in the height of the civil war. And he was actually coming back with 3-month-old twins. And he said, you know, we wish them every success. We wish that we could have done this, that they didn't need the U.S. to go in and topple a dictator.
Do leaders in Iraq worry about popular protests in their own country?
That is such a great question. I think in other countries they worry. I think in this country, you have a country that was under incredible repression for decades. And it was brutal enough that when people did try to protest, they were very strongly put down. And I think that has instilled a fear here. Now, we have seen public protests, but really, people aren't very good at protests in Iraq. They either knuckle under to authority or they go along with things, and they kind of get by. There isn't a real sense here that there could be those sort of protests. They've just had an election, for better or worse. This is a democracy of sorts. It needs fixing, most people would say, but it's not quite at the stage yet where anyone thinks you're going to see those kind of protests in the street.
Correspondent Jane Aruff in Baghdad speaking with us about the Iraqis who are returning home from Egypt. Thanks very much, Jane.
Thank you.
In recent days, some commentators have described Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak as the country's last pharaoh. It's a good soundbite, but it may not tell the whole story. The World's Alex Galifant reports.
Egyptians play fast and loose with their famous heritage. After all, the national soccer team is nicknamed the Pharaohs. But when it comes to politics, says Joshua Stacker at Kent State University, calling somebody a pharaoh is an insult.
If we go back 4,000 years, pharaohs were kings that ruled for life and built grand monuments to themselves and ruled arbitrarily and divided and ruled. So it's not a good term.
And Stacker disputes the idea that Mubarak is the last pharaoh.
I mean, there's plenty of pharaohs that are standing right behind him as we speak in the palace ready to take over. It's not a term of endearment.
Maybe not right now, but the pyramids of the pharaohs cast long shadows in Cairo. where Tarek Osman lives. He's the author of Egypt on the Brink.
The pharaoh also in the Egyptian psyche is the semi-god who ensured the provision of water to the Egyptian peasants, and that is an extremely positive role in the deep Egyptian psyche.
But over the past 50 or 60 years, Osman says the notion of the pharaoh has morphed into a more generic father of the nation idea, a change encouraged by Hosni Mubarak and his predecessors, Presidents Nasser and Sadat. Nasser portrayed himself as the inspiring leader of a national regeneration.
It was more of a grandeur of a historical project. Sadat adopted a completely different modus operandi. Sadat was the umda, as we say in Egypt, the man who attends the weddings and the funerals, and his choice of words were very colloquial, unlike Nasser, who mastered the classic Arabic language. So Sadat enacted a very different patriarch role.
And then came Mubarak. And unlike the other two, he came from a military background. For him, building a strongman narrative fit best.
The firm, solid protector. Protect the land, protect the people, protect the national security.
Sounds familiar, especially to Russians. They have their own deep-rooted ideal of leadership, the Tsar.
The image of the Tsar is alive and well in Russia today.
Marshall Poe is a historian at the University of Iowa.
Russians strongly believe that Russia is the kind of country that needs what they call a strong hand. It is a legacy of Tsarism. It is also a legacy of Soviet rule. And the basic premise here is that Russia is a very unruly place, that Russians themselves are unruly, and therefore they need somebody powerful in the center to make things run right.
Stalin was a Tsar of sorts. Now Putin is. History suggests that Russians don't trust themselves to run things. A form of democracy came to Russia in the 90s, and yet the figure of the Tsar persists. It speaks to a deep-seated mistrust of democracy that's not really that unusual around the world.
It's pretty rare to walk up to somebody and go, do you think if we put power in the hands of, like, everyone, that things would be okay? They would look at you like you were from Mars. The idea that, you know, inside every Egyptian or North Korean or something, there's like an American trying to get out and go to the polling booth is false.
A couple days ago, after President Mubarak promised not to stand for re-election, Tarek Osman listened to Egyptians calling in to live radio programs. He says many repeated the same thing.
So he is our father. He is our father. If you just make a survey of how many times the word father was said, I think it was by far more than any other word.
Osman says the contemporary mixture of pharaoh and father figure embodied by Hosni Mubarak won't go simply when he goes. But he does expect it to fade. More and more Egyptians are educated and connected. And for them, the pharaoh belongs only in the museum. For The World, I'm Alex Galifant.
Be sure to head to theworld.org/Egypt for our complete coverage and links to live 24-hour updates from our partners at the BBC. News headlines from the BBC in London are next here on PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up, an Israeli heavy metal band that somehow manages to reflect popular discontent across the Middle East.
If we want to describe the anger of people fighting each other and killing each other in the name of God, distorted guitars and growlings will be the best filter to do it.
PRI's The World is brought to you by the Medtronic Foundation, partnering with Mended Hearts to provide online and hospital support to newly diagnosed heart disease patients. Learn more at mendedhearts.org.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. Egypt's President Hosni Mubarak said in an interview with ABC that he'd like to resign, but he fears chaos might ensue. But unrest is already disrupting life in Egypt, and there are worries that traffic in the Suez Canal could be slowed or even halted. So far, the strategic channel remains open, and that's key to global commerce, as The World's Laura Lynch reports.
More than 140 years old, the Suez Canal sped the pace of shipping by providing a shortcut between Europe and Asia, eliminating the need to sail around the southern tip of Africa. Nearly a century after its creation, Egypt's nationalist president, Gamal Abdel Nasser, hit Western nations where he knew it would hurt, announcing to cheering crowds in 1956 that Egypt would control the waterway. That led to the Suez Crisis, a military invasion of Egypt, and an eventual ceasefire, all in the space of a few months. Today, Michelle Dunn of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace says the canal still plays a pivotal role.
And that is a critical choke point for commercial traffic, for oil, military vessels, and so forth. So it's very useful to the United States, or indeed to any power that really wants to be able to operate freely and both militarily and commercially in the Middle East.
So any hint of trouble is enough to drive up oil prices. The chief economist of the International Energy Agency, Fatih Bindal, is trying to play down those fears in the wake of the unrest in North Africa.
Of course, everybody thinks of the Suez Canal, where it's a major route for oil transportation. But as far as we know, there is not a major significant threat to the oil supplies in the Suez Canal.
Still, the unrest has caused two shipping companies to suspend their canal operations. The government reportedly deployed soldiers to guard the canal. But Egyptian businessman Mahmoud Youssef calls that an overreaction.
The youth that you see in the streets of Egypt have no intention whatsoever of destroying the infrastructure or the economy of the country. If you ask me, can it happen? I say yes. Is it likely to happen? I say no.
Youssef worries about something else, though, something that could drive the price of oil much higher.
What can happen and what can be of much more significance is the spillover from Egypt to other countries in the Gulf area. Don't tell me that other countries don't have the same problems. They have similar problems. And that can put the oil prices, 100 is nothing. It can be even 200.
That's $200 a barrel. Whatever happens to oil, there's something else to consider. The problems mean Egyptian businesses cannot export other goods. Even if the ports were operating normally, companies consider it unsafe to use roads or railways. So food and other goods are piling up, along with the damage to Egypt's economy. For The World, I'm Laura Lynch.
Another key to the Egyptian economy and to life itself in the country is the Nile River. Without the Nile, Egypt would be almost all barren desert. But right now, with Cairo in crisis, several upriver countries are closing in on a deal over who controls the Nile's waters. Here to fill us in is Stephen Solomon. He's the author of Water, The Epic Struggle for Wealth, Power, and Civilization. Now, this agreement is called the Comprehensive Framework Agreement, Stephen, but basically it applies to the nine countries, 10 if you include the soon-to-be South Sudan in Africa that depend on the Nile. What's in this treaty?
Well, for the first time, the countries upriver are trying to claim a significant share of the water of the Nile River for their own development, including Ethiopia, which supplies 85% of the water that arrives at Aswan, but up till this current time has taken almost nothing out of the river. So Egypt has lived upon the Nile and has for 5,000 years, and now they are really being asked to give back some of that water rights. They don't want to do that, and they have not signed on to the treaty as a result.
And just to be clear, when we say upriver, we're actually talking about countries that are south of Egypt, Kenya, Ethiopia, all the way down to Burundi and Rwanda that depend on the Nile River basin.
That's correct. The river is in two parts. There is the Blue Nile, which originates in Ethiopia out of the highlands and supplies most of the water that arrives at Aswan. There is the White Nile, which is arrives from, as you mentioned, in the highlands of Central Africa, and that too then joins the river, but not a significant amount of it adds to the water at Aswan at the moment.
So Egypt has rejected this comprehensive framework agreement. Does Egypt have a legal right to say it has more of a claim to Nile water than any of the countries who have signed the agreement so far?
Well, this is, of course, what's being negotiated. They claim they do because they signed in 1959 a treaty with Sudan, in which they claimed the right to all the water. Egypt took three-quarters of it and allocated one-quarter to Sudan. Ethiopia and the others maintained that they were really legally not included in the negotiations, which they were not, and it goes back to the British colonial rule, whether legal interpretations are on one side or the other.
Apparently, only six countries need to sign this, and it could go through without Egypt signing it. Isn't that right?
Yeah, they're waiting for Burundi. Well, they're waiting for Burundi to sign on. But frankly, a treaty without Egypt and without Sudan, but especially without Egypt, is not much of a treaty at all, to be quite honest.
What needs to happen in order for Egypt to sign on to the agreement?
That's a good question. Look, when Anwar Sadat made peace with Israel in 1979, he immediately said the only thing that could take Egypt to war again are the waters of the Nile. I mean, the Nile is that important to Egypt.
Well, how could Egypt work around it if the treaty is in effect and it gets all the signatories?
Good question. They've done all they can in the past 30 years to use all their diplomacy, even threats of war, to prevent the development by the states upriver. And I don't think that they have a great case to make to be able to do that.
You know, if there's a new government in Cairo next fall, or if there's a revolutionary government before then, I can't imagine them taking this agreement lying down. Do you think Egypt is in a position right now to even be thinking about water and the Nile?
Well, they're always thinking about it, but they're obviously in no position to negotiate from any position of that's going to have a lot of credibility. And frankly, giving up any of their water rights in this environment by any government is fairly suicidal, because Egyptians have depended on the Nile for 5,000 years. It's ingrained into their historic right, as they call it. It's ingrained into their national psyche. I mean, it is that vital to them that they do need to have some guarantee that would seem pretty solid that they're going to have their water. And that is not, I don't see how that is going to be possible in the near-term future.
Stephen Solomon, thanks very much indeed.
Thank you very much.
Stephen Solomon is author of Water, The Epic Struggle for Wealth, Power, and Civilization. The causes of the current turmoil in Egypt are complex and decades in the making. You might think of the picture as a tapestry woven from many different threads. And as unlikely as it may sound, one of those threads might be global climate change. Here's the world's environment editor, Peter Thompson.
The throngs of protesters in the streets of Cairo this week have a host of grievances. There's the decades of authoritarian rule, of course, the lack of political expression or economic opportunity. But the uprising grew in part out of protests against high food prices. Food price inflation in Egypt was over 20% last year. In particular, there's been a big squeeze from the rising global price of wheat, according to New York global investment manager Vincent Truglia.
Wheat prices have gone up, depending on the measure, between 50 and 70% in 2010. And this has just devastated Egyptian budgets.
That's partly because Egypt is among the world's largest importers of wheat. And the global wheat market received a number of nasty shocks recently. The worst came last summer when Russia was hit by an unprecedented drought and heat wave. Russia lost 40% of its wheat harvest and abruptly banned exports. Egypt was left scrambling because it had just signed a big wheat deal with Russia. The Egyptian government has tried to keep a lid on wheat prices through subsidies and rationing, but Truglia says anxiety over food prices is the key problem facing Egypt today. And some trace the problem, at least in part, to climate change.
I think we are seeing some of the early effects of climate change on food security.
Veteran environmental analyst Lester Brown of the Earth Policy Institute says last year's Russian heat wave, which led to the wheat collapse, was no ordinary weather event.
If someone had told me that there was likely to be a heat wave in Russia in which the average temperature would be 14 degrees Fahrenheit above the norm, that's pushing the envelope. I mean, 4 degrees would be a lot.
Brown and many others say the Russian heat wave was only one of several recent events affecting global food supply that likely were linked to climate change. And he believes that the stresses these events are putting on food supplies are contributing to unrest around the world.
You can't prove that link, but you can say it is highly likely that that is the case.
Of course, many observers dismiss this as far-fetched speculation. They say the possible impacts of climate change on political events are too remote and diffuse for anyone to credibly connect the dots. But Brown has some surprising compatriots.
The adverse effects of bad weather caused by climate change act as a threat multiplier for instability in critical parts of the world.
That's retired Admiral Dennis McGinn. He contributed to an influential report for the Pentagon on the security implications of climate change. Like Brown, Admiral McGinn says you can rarely draw a straight line of causation between climate change and political upheaval. He says there are usually many underlying causes, but that climate change may well be one of them.
If you have long-term droughts, crop failures in other parts of the world, too much water in the form of flooding, you have added pressure to the already existing fault lines in fragile societies with fragile governments. And certainly Egypt would fall into that category.
So if that's true, where does that leave us? McGinn says we need to start looking at ways to reduce the shocks and volatility that climate changes will bring to food supplies and other global markets. He says that means new investments in things like drought-resistant crops, better water management, and new ways of managing and distributing food. None of this will end the threat of instability around the world, McGinn says, but it might help remove at least one thread of volatility in Egypt and beyond. For The World, I'm Peter Thompson.
Our GeoQuiz now. We're taking a pilgrimage of sorts. We're looking for a tiny tidal island right off the coast of Normandy in France. It's famous for its breathtaking setting and is crowned by an abbey whose foundation dates back to the 8th century. Over time, the abbey became a destination for religious pilgrims, although now it's hard to separate the pilgrims from the tourists. A whopping 3 million visitors each year come here. Soon, though, there may be something else for tourists to see along this stretch of coast, wind turbines, and that's causing some angst. More on that in just seconds. First, name this island off the coast of Normandy. You have just a few seconds to figure it out. The name of the island we're talking about is Mont-Saint-Michel. The French government is planning to install 3 wind turbines just a few miles off the coast, and some critics say that could spoil the view and cost Mont-Saint-Michel its precious status as a UNESCO World Heritage Site. Henry Samuel is covering the story for Britain's Telegraph newspaper.
A UNESCO World Heritage Site comes with a lot of prestige, of course, and also some financial help in upkeeping the site. So Mont-Saint-Michel will not want to lose that. At this stage, it's difficult to say whether there really will be any impact on it. But at any rate, there are a bunch of environmental groups, particularly, who are very angry about the idea of having 3 towering wind farms off the coast of Normandy, where the Mont-Saint-Michel is. And they have contacted UNESCO, who in turn have written to the local authorities saying that they are concerned. And now the French government this week has had to submit a kind of report explaining exactly what they're going to do, and UNESCO has to look at that and decide whether to take action.
Well, let's talk in a couple of minutes about some of the concerns, some of the critiques of this proposal, but there have been debates here around the installation of wind turbines off the coast of Cape Cod, for example, but with something that's a religious site, I imagine the controversy is even worse. How much protest has there been?
Well, this is kind of the early stages in the protest, but obviously they've clubbed together. There's more than one environmental group. And they claim that, in fact, a lot of it comes down to light pollution at night. You're going to see kind of twinkling lights that they describe as like a Christmas garland that you'll be seeing from the coast that will spoil the view. And that at the moment there's a very quote-unquote pure view over the sea from this amazing abbey that comes up into the sky that's been there since the 8th century. And used to be a pilgrimage site in the Middle Ages. So it's quite an emotive issue. And those people who are actually going to build the wind farm say, look, they're going to be 20 kilometers off the coast.
Right, it's about 15 miles or so.
About 15 miles off the coast. They'll be the size of matchsticks, really. There's no fuss. But there are a lot of people who are worried about it.
You know, you talk about these environmentalists who are worried about light pollution and spoiling the view, but I imagine most environmentalists are saying, look, this is a different time. We need to shift to renewable energy. We have to build these turbines, and they got to go where the wind is.
Yeah, it's very strange. There's quite an emotive issue, but there seems to be quite a lot of environmentalists against these offshore generators. And don't forget that France creates 80% of its electricity from nuclear power plants. And it's not just Mont-Saint-Michel. There are a whole load of wind turbines that are due to be erected by 2015. In fact, the president has announced a 10 billion euro tender to create lots of them along the Atlantic coast. And they're also considering putting up a whole load of wind farms in Normandy, where the D-Day beaches, where, of course, many Americans lost their lives during the Second World War on the Normandy landings. And that's caused problems too.
Right. Would that have any effect on the local tourism business there?
Well, it's not just a question of tourism. You've actually got the president of the official body that commemorates D-Day in France saying that it's really inappropriate to have these wind farms really within the view of the five landing beaches on which 2,500 Allied soldiers died on the 6th of June, 1944. And here, they're also trying to turn that into a UNESCO World Heritage Site. And again, the argument is, well, UNESCO is not going to want to do that if you create all of these wind farms.
Henry Samuel with Britain's Telegraph newspaper speaking with us about the wind farm plans on the north coast of France. Thanks very much for your time.
Thanks.
This is PRI. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Still ahead, a heavy metal soundtrack for Arab Anger. But first, we wanted to check in with the world's cartoon maven, Carol Hill. She's been collecting cartoonist reactions to the drama in Egypt, and you can see what she's found at our website, theworld.org. Carol, there's been no shortage of material for political cartoonists this week. What kind of stuff are you seeing?
Well, it's pretty incredible. The most interesting stuff is from Middle Eastern cartoonists themselves, from Lebanon to Jordan, Israel, and Egypt. We just got a few in today from Egypt. And that's what's great. Cartoonists who I usually don't hear from, usually don't publish much from the Middle East, they're all over the place. And we're seeing all sorts of Egyptian symbols, from pharaohs to hieroglyphs to pyramids, all used for imagery. Beginning of the week was sort of friendly and, you know, hands across the water. And now you have images of, you know, people throwing stones from pyramids and camels. So it's a whole different look. And we have two slideshows, one from Middle Eastern cartoonists and the other from non-Middle Eastern cartoonists.
And people who go to theworld.org, can they expect to see a wide range of views and opinions with these cartoonists? Or do these cartoons seem to take sides in a particular theme?
Well, much of it was celebratory. Isn't this great? And then there's been a few cautionary cartoons about, well, gee, what about Muslim Brotherhood? Most of it has been celebratory and now simply commenting visually on the demonstrations, which have now turned violent and less fun.
All that's available and can be seen at theworld.org. The World's Carol Hills, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Marco.
The anger we're seeing on the streets of Egypt and in the Arab world has been building for a long time. There are all sorts of reasons: lack of free speech, dismal economies, sectarian wars. Some solace can be had through screaming in a public square or through song. Heavy metal has grown on a parallel track with that Middle East anger, especially among young people. This band is a hit among Arabs in the region, even though the place where it's from isn't. Orphaned Land is the name of this band, and they're from Israel. But their music is becoming the battle cry of young people throughout the Middle East. Daniel Estrin went to a concert in Tel Aviv and brings us this report.
The fans have tattoos, leather boots, t-shirts decorated with skulls. The guitarist on stage is a bouncing blob of long hair. Nothing unusual for metalheads, I thought. But then I went backstage and met lead singer Kobe Farhi, and he started talking like a flower child.
The land who gives us so many fruits, so many vegetables, so many air to breathe. This is just love.
Is this the same man who sings this?
People stereotype heavy metal as something who is not the way it truly is. We are breaking all stereotypes, simply as that, of music, of religion, of politics, of nationality. We're just here to break it.
Farhi wants you to look past his tattoos, all 11 of them, and try to understand why heavy metal speaks to him and to so many young people in the Middle East.
I was a teenager, and when I discovered metal, I felt that this is the only true thing that I have discovered in this world, the only thing that was without any masks.
Farhi says he got sick of fanatics masking their beliefs as religion. He got sick of the endless wars plaguing the Middle East. This song is called Disciples of the Sacred Oath 2. It's from their latest album. It directly addresses the conflict between Jews and Muslims in the region.
We're speaking with our Muslim brothers. It's like we're speaking to them face to face in this song. Asking them, shall we see the end of war, blood brothers, or shall we fill another grave for ourselves we couldn't save?
This isn't a song of peace strummed on a guitar around a campfire.
Yeah, anger is a part of our art. I mean, if we want to describe the wrath of God, or if we want to describe the anger of people fighting each other and killing each other in the name of God, distorted guitars and growlings will be the best filter to do it.
Orphanland actually came onto the scene 20 years ago, mixing Middle Eastern melodies with quotes from the Quran and the Bible. This song takes its lyrics from a 400-year-old Yemenite Jewish poem. Ears perked up throughout the region, and the band gained fans in Arab countries, where they usually have no exposure to Israeli culture. For some Arab fans, it's been risky. Farhi says a while back, an Egyptian fan got 6 months in jail because he had an Orphanland CD. The authorities said the music was Satanism. So then, when the band went on a 6-year hiatus, the usual rock band nonsense, they got an email from a fan in Jordan who sent a video attachment showing his tattoo of the Orphanland logo.
This was a moment that changed our life. And I understood right there that the band is the most important thing that we could do. So the Israeli Orphanland was resurrected by an Arab guy.
When the unrest in Egypt broke out last week, Orphanland sent a shout-out to their Egyptian fans on Facebook. Many Egyptian fans replied with gratitude. The band recently performed in Turkey at a time when Turkish-Israeli relations are at an all-time low. When the band was there, they got a peace award from a Turkish university. And they met fans from Iran and Syria, countries that are sworn enemies of Israel. That's the beauty of what the band stands for, says one Israeli fan in Tel Aviv.
So you can still practice your religion and still have peaceful relations with people around you. So that's the message, and that's good.
You don't need to flood the streets of Tunisia or Egypt to challenge the norm in the Middle East. Banging your head to Quranic lyrics and tearing your vocal cords singing Jewish poetry? Around these parts, subversion can take many forms. For The World, I'm Daniel Estrin, Tel Aviv.
Land's music brings this program to a close. We're always online at theworld.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for joining us.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the Plowshares Fund, investing in peace and security worldwide, plowshares.org, the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art, and by the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can, and NASA, leading research on the Earth and its climate from the vantage point of space.
PRI, Public Radio International.